If you saw someone, being harassed right now, you probably think you'd step in.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, everyone wants to be the hero.
Right. We all want to believe we're the hero of our own story, like ready to leap to the defense of a stranger on a crowded train or step up when a colleague is backed into a corner.
Yeah, but statistically, your brain is already hardwired to make you look the other way.
It really is, and that's exactly what we are getting into today. We are taking a deep dive into this incredibly comprehensive resource. It's a 54-lesson online training course from HalfSL UK.
Titled Safe Bystander Intervention.
Exactly. And our mission for this deep dive is to basically take that massive amount of material and shortcut your path to being a confident, effective bystander.
Because nobody wants to feel paralyzed.
No. Nobody does. We're extracting the core psychological insights and the practical tools so that, the next time you get that tight, cold feeling in your stomach, you don't just freeze. You're actually prepped for the real world.
And to really wrap our heads around the scope of that paralysis, we have to look at the data driving this course. Because ASSL conducted this huge global survey in October of 2025.
Over 7,500 participants, right?
Yeah, over 7,500. And the findings, well, they present a pretty stark reality check. Like 62% of people who witness street harassment just ignore it entirely.
Wow, 62%.
Or they just don't know how to respond, you know? They watch it happen and they just keep walking.
Which sounds terrible, but the course doesn't actually present this as like an empathy deficit.
No, not at all. Because there's this secondary statistic that completely changes the narrative. Over 82% of those same respondents said that if they actually knew how to intervene safely, they would step in.
So the willingness is totally there.
Exactly. The willingness is there, the toolkit is just missing.
Okay, well, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because before we even get to the tactical toolkit, the source material forces this massive shift in how we define the problem in the first place.
It really does reframe everything.
Yeah, I mean, we so often wait for a cinematic moment,
Yeah.
right? Someone shouting insults or obvious physical aggression before we feel justified in calling it harassment.
We try to read the aggressor's mind.
Right. We try to figure out if they mean harm. But the course argues that harassment is absolutely not about the perpetrator's intent.
Not at all.
It is purely about the impact on the target. Like, if someone's comfort or agency is taken away even for a single second, that's the only metric that matters.
Yeah.
That's a red flag.
And honestly, that shift relieves such an immense cognitive burden for the bystander.
How so?
Well, when you witness an uncomfortable interaction, your brain usually ties itself in knots, trying to act as judge and jury.
Oh, sure. You're like, is this a misunderstanding? Are they just overly friendly?
Exactly. But by focusing entirely on the target's impact, you don't need like a courtroom level of proof. You only need to look at their body language.
Just reading the room.
Yeah. Are their shoulders creeping up to their ears? You know, are they offering that forced, polite laughter while physically angling their body toward the exit?
I know exactly the laugh you mean.
We all do. And the text emphasizes that your gut instinct is actually a highly evolved radar system. If you sense the target is distressed, the intent of the person causing it is totally irrelevant.
Which brings up a really frustrating paradox, I think. Because if our gut is so highly evolved at spotting distress, why does that same evolutionary wiring betray us when it's time to actually act?
That is the million-dollar question.
I really want to explore why our default setting, 62% of the time, is to freeze. The source material outlines 10 specific barriers that create this hesitation.
Grouping them into biological and social roadblocks.
Right. And I was completely struck by the biological piece. Because we usually think of the freeze response as a failure of courage.
When it's actually an ancient survival mechanism.
Exactly. When your amygdala perceives a threat, even if that threat is just a guy talking way too loud to a woman on the subway, it floods your system with stress hormones.
It's trying to camouflage you.
Yes. It's a literal physiological shutdown designed to keep the predator from noticing you.
And while that biological freeze acts as the initial brake, the social roadblocks are what permanently park the car.
Okay, that's a great way to put it.
The course breaks down several of these, but two of them are incredibly pervasive. The first is pluralistic ignorance.
Pluralistic ignorance. What does that look like in practice?
Well, when something ambiguous happens, human beings instinctively look at the faces of the people around them to gauge how to react.
Like checking to see if anyone else is panicking.
Right. And if everyone else is masking their discomfort and acting calm, you subconsciously decide, oh, I guess this isn't an emergency.
So the collective silence basically convinces the whole group that no action is required.
Exactly. It's this invisible feedback loop of doing absolutely
You're
nothing.
looking at the guy across from you to see if you should act, and he's looking at you doing nothing, so he does nothing.
And that leads right into the second major social roadblock the text hits on, which is the diffusion of responsibility.
Also known as the bystander effect. Okay, let's unpack this, because it feels a lot like seeing a smoking microwave in the office break room.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
Right. You walk in, it smells like burning plastic, but there are like three other people just drinking coffee nearby. Your brain instantly assumes someone else already called maintenance.
You assume it must be handled.
Yeah, so you don't call, they don't call, and the microwave just catches fire.
And the larger the crowd, the larger the fire. The brain finds safety in assuming the bartender or the bus driver or the person standing closest will intervene.
But nobody does.
Right. But what's fascinating here is how the course dismantles this. It challenges the reader to adopt a totally new internal assumption.
Which is what?
You have to assume no one else is going to do anything. You just have to assume the mantle of first responder simply because the crowd is waiting for someone, anyone, really, to break the social script and give them permission to care.
I mean, I can wrap my head around breaking the script for a stranger on a subway. That makes sense. But I struggle with one of the specific barriers the text brings up, which is the fear of intervening in a private situation.
Yes, the domestic dispute scenario.
Yeah. What if it actually is a private situation, like a couple having a tense, escalating argument on the sidewalk? The text says we shouldn't assume it's private and walk away, but intervening there feels incredibly intrusive.
It feels dangerous, honestly.
Yeah, potentially dangerous. I don't want to play referee for two people I don't even know.
Well, this raises an important question, and it's a distinction the source material handles brilliantly. The hesitation comes from conflating intervention with resolution.
Wait, say more about that.
You do not need to play referee. You don't need to take a side, mediate their conflict, or even acknowledge what they are arguing about.
So what are you supposed to do?
The intervention is purely about creating a cognitive interrupt. The text suggests using a completely mundane, polite interruption.
Like what?
You approach and ask, "Excuse me, do you know if there's a pharmacy around here?" Or, "Hey, can you tell me what time it is?"
So you just inject something entirely out of context into their reality.
Yes. The underlying psychology is that escalating conflicts operate on a very specific momentum.
Right.
When a stranger interrupts with a polite, totally unrelated question, social conditioning kicks in. The aggressor often pauses to process the unexpected stimulus.
Oh, wow. It forces a temporary de-escalation.
Exactly. But more importantly, it gives the target a crucial window. They suddenly have a few seconds of breathing room to physically step away, assess their safety, or signal to you that they need help.
And you do all that without ever actually addressing the nature of their argument.
Precisely.
It's like offering them a fire escape rather than trying to put out the fire yourself.
That's a great way to look at it.
But executing something like that in a high-stress moment takes more than just, recognizing the concept. It takes a preloaded script.
It really does. You can't be making it up on the fly.
Right? Because if our brains freeze because they don't know what to do next, we have to bypass the thinking phase entirely.
And that is exactly what the course provides. It's a framework originally developed by the organization Right to Be.
The five Ds, right?
Yes, the five Ds: direct, distract, delegate, document, and delay.
So let's decode these, because exploring these five strategies reveals why this framework is taught globally.
It's because it recognizes that not every tool works for every person in every scenario.
Let's start with the first one, direct.
Right. The first D, direct, is the most traditional form of intervention. It involves using calm, firm language to name the behavior and set a boundary.
Like saying, that comment's not appropriate, or, hey, give him some space.
Exactly. But the text stresses that this must be done without aggression. The goal is to establish a boundary, not to win an argument or provoke the harasser.
But the source is also very realistic that confronting someone directly isn't always safe, which makes the second D, distract, incredibly valuable.
Oh, distract is brilliant.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The course suggests turning bystander intervention into a bit of improvisational theater.
I love this part.
Right. Instead of confronting the harasser, you shift all the attention to the target by pretending you know them.
You just walk right up.
Yeah, you walk up, smile, and say, "Oh my gosh, Sarah, I haven't seen you since college. How have you been?" You can make up a name, a backstory, and just bulldoze your way into the conversation.
It sounds mortifying to try if you're shy, but it's a genius tactic.
It really is.
Yeah.
You act like a highly inconvenient, totally oblivious friend, just completely ignoring the harasser.
And the mechanism behind why distract is so effective is deeply tied to the harasser's strategy, because harassment relies heavily on isolation.
They want the target to be alone.
Right. The perpetrator banks on the target being isolated and the crowd staying out of it. So the moment you introduce a perceived social connection, you destroy the isolation.
The dynamic fundamentally shifts because the target is no longer alone.
Exactly.
But okay, if playing improv isn't your speed, or if the situation just feels too volatile, we move to the third D delegate.
The act of outsourcing the intervention.
Right. But the text frames this as more than just pointing the finger at someone else. It's about strategically identifying someone with institutional or social authority in that specific environment.
Like a flight attendant or a store manager or maybe a security guard.
Yeah.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, delegating is about altering the power dynamic. A harasser might feel comfortable intimidating a lone passenger, right?
Sure.
But they are way less likely to continue if an employee with the power to actually remove them from the premises gets involved. You are transferring the social burden from yourself to a structural authority.
That makes total sense. Then we have the fourth D, which is document. And I want to spend a minute here because the text provides a massive course correction on how society currently views filming incidents.
It really is a necessary correction.
Because we live in this world of viral outrage, where people pull out their phones to expose a harasser, post it to social media, and try to get them canceled.
But the course is explicit about this. Safe bystander intervention is not about vigilantism. The true purpose of documenting a situation has been heavily distorted. The text clarifies that the goal is solely to give power and evidence back to the victim.
So, how do they recommend doing it?
The methodology is very specific. You maintain a safe distance. You film to capture context like landmarks or street signs, and you narrate the date and time if possible.
But the most critical step happens after the harassment stops, right?
Yes, you approach the target and offer them the footage.
And you explicitly do not post it without their consent.
Under no circumstances do you post it.
Okay, emphasize that because that's
It
huge.
is huge because trauma strips away a person's agency. When a bystander posts video of someone's victimization online without asking, even with the best intentions of exposing the harasser, they are subjecting the victim to a second violation of their agency.
Oh, wow. I never thought about it like that.
Yeah, they are forcing the victim's trauma onto a public stage, but handing over the footage and saying, "Hey, I have this if you want it, but I will delete it right now if you prefer," that restores the target's control.
They get to choose whether to go to HR, the authorities, or simply hit delete.
Exactly.
It transforms filming from an act of content creation into an act of profound service.
Beautifully said.
And that brings us to the final D, delay. This one feels like the ultimate grace period for the
It
bystander.
really is.
Because despite all this training, there will be times when the harassment happens too fast, or the freeze response completely wins out and the moment just passes you by.
It happens to everyone.
Right. So delay means checking in with the target after the fact. You wait until the harassers are gone, approach the person, and say, "I saw what just happened. That was really not okay. Are you all right? Can I walk you somewhere?"
And while it obviously doesn't stop the harassment in the moment, we cannot underestimate the psychological triage that delay provides.
Because it validates their experience.
Exactly. Harassment is an exercise in gaslighting. When a target is mistreated in a public space and everyone ignores it, they begin to internalize that isolation.
They wonder if they imagined the severity of it.
Or worse, they feel entirely invisible to their community. So by approaching them afterward, you validate their reality. You prove they were seen.
You help mitigate the long-term psychological damage just by confirming that the behavior was wrong and they aren't alone.
Right.
It completely reframes what it means to fail at intervening. Even if you completely miss your cue, your role isn't over.
Not at all.
But having these five distinct tools, direct, distract, delegate, document, delay, means you have to make a rapid decision about which one to actually deploy.
And the course makes it very clear that this decision is not just about personal preference.
No, it's deeply tied to situational awareness and something the text calls positionality.
Right. Positionality is a cornerstone of this entire framework. It asks you to evaluate your own identity, your social power, and your physical safety in any given room.
Because there is no universally correct way to step in, right? The risks are not distributed equally.
Exactly. A senior manager interrupting a sexist joke in a boardroom carries entirely different professional weight than a new junior employee trying to do the same thing.
Right. The manager has the social capital to be direct without fearing retaliation.
While the junior employee might need to rely on delay or delegate.
And it extends way beyond the workplace into physical public spaces, too. The text points out that men, male-presenting individuals, or physically larger people, generally navigate the world with a built-in buffer of physical safety.
They carry a structural shield.
Right. They can utilize the direct approach with a significantly lower risk of the harasser turning physically violent toward them.
Conversely, the text acknowledges the intense reality for marginalized groups: people of color, members of the LGBTQIA+ community, disabled women. They often face a drastically compounded risk if they confront a harasser.
A situation can rapidly escalate into targeted violence against the intervener.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean for those vulnerable groups? I mean, I can imagine someone reading that section of the course and thinking, okay, the text acknowledges I'm at higher risk, therefore it's not my job to intervene.
I get a free pass.
Yeah, exactly. I get a free pass to walk away.
Exactly. If you are in a vulnerable position, your mandate is to use the tools that keep you safe. You delegate to the bartender who has authority, or you document from a safe distance.
Or you delay and offer support after.
Yes. The text distills this into a really powerful operating principle. If you can step in safely, do it for those who can't.
Do it for those who can't. That's powerful.
It completely shifts bystander intervention away from the idea of individual heroism and grounds it in collective responsibility.
We are an ecosystem.
Right. No single person is expected to do everything, but every single person is expected to do something. You assess your positionality, choose the D that aligns with your safety, and take action.
So let's synthesize the journey we've taken through this Hassall's training today. We started by dismantling the need to read minds, right? If an action negatively impacts someone's comfort, it's harassment.
Intent doesn't matter.
Exactly. Then we map the psychological roadblocks that cause us to freeze in the first place, from the amygdala's survival tactics to the insidious trap of the bystander effect and pluralistic ignorance.
The smoking microwave.
The smoking microwave. And we replace that paralysis with a tactical script. You have the five Ds. You can direct, distract, delegate, document, or delay.
You evaluating your own safety and privilege in the moment to pick the right tool.
But simply walking away is no longer an option on the table.
And the overarching thesis of this deep dive is that harassment fundamentally requires an audience of silence to thrive.
It feeds on silence.
It does. When a perpetrator acts out and the crowd says nothing, they receive tacit social permission to escalate.
Right.
But the moment you step in, even in the smallest, most awkward way, like spilling your coffee as a distraction or asking a confusing question about a pharmacy, you shatter that
You
permission.
don't just help the person being targeted.
No, you visibly alter the social norms of the entire space.
Yeah.
You provide irrefutable, real-time evidence that this behavior is rejected by the community.
Every action creates a ripple effect. You change the culture of the room you're standing in.
It's so true.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with a final lingering thought to explore on your own. We've spent this entire time analyzing how intervening changes the environment, how it protects the victim, and how it deters the harasser. But what happens to our own internal psychology when we do nothing?
Yeah.
What is the unseen cost to our own sense of courage and self-respect when we continually condition ourselves to look away from discomfort? Next time you see a situation unfolding and your brain begs you just keep walking, next time you feel that deep urge to freeze, consider that choosing to step in isn't just about rescuing the person being targeted. It might just be how you rescue a little bit of your own humanity, too.